everyone. Welcome back. This is Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, the land of the geeks. Thank you for tuning in today. If you're a new listener, the websites you need to keep an eye on is redicecreations.com, redicecreations.net, and also redicemembers.com. Also, make sure to subscribe to our RSS feeds and have the latest content coming directly to you. Today, we are going to continue on the Viking Trail with Professor Martin Biddle. He is a British archaeologist and academic. He is an emeritus fellow of Hertford College, Oxford. His work was important in the development of medieval and post-medieval archaeology in Great Britain. Mr. Biddle is the gentleman who, together with his Danish wife, discovered the Viking burials at Repton in England. We are going to talk about how the great heathen army used the old Anglo-Saxon church as part of their defense wall as they stayed there in the winter of 873 to 874. We are going to speak more about the finds in the Viking mounds, all the skeletons, the weapons, and also talk about the prospects that Ivar the Boneless, or Ivar Ragnarsson, one of the sons of Ragnar Lothbrok, was buried in Repton. We have some fascinating reports of a 9-foot-tall giant skeleton being found there. Very strange, but intriguing reports indeed. We'll get Mr. Biddle's take on this and much more during this extended segment. Welcome, Mr. Biddle. Thank you so much for coming on the program with us. It's an honor to have you here. Thank you so much for taking time off your busy schedule speaking with us today.
Oh, that's all right. It's just coming on the evening. I'm just delaying my supper. Don't worry.
All right. Very good. Well, you and your wife, of course, have done digs at Repton in the UK that has produced some of the most fascinating and extraordinary finds that has given us an insight really beyond the stories about what really happened in England during the charge, if we can call it that, of the Great Heathen Army. Tell us, first of all, how you got involved and when you got involved in the excavations at Repton.
Well, a very long time ago, because I'm 77 now, and during the war, the Second World War, not the first, I was actually living in the village of Repton because my father had been posted up there. Well, there's an officer training unit near Repton, and he was up there. And so we lived in Repton for about 4 years, right in the middle of England. Wonderful experience for a young boy. I learned how to ride horses, and I went to the kindergarten, and I knew the church at Repton very, very well, and used to be allowed to play around it and in and out of its crypt and so on. Everything was very informal. So that's how I got to know Repton initially. And then what happened was that my late wife, by the way, Beata, died in, fortunately, in 2010.
I did not know that.
No, well, it's sad business. My late wife and I had a very great friend called Dr. Harold Taylor, who was many things. I mean, he was a ski mountaineer. He was a gold medal artilleryman in the Second World War. He was treasurer of the University of Cambridge, and then vice chancellor of the University of Kiel, a newer university in our Midlands. But his great interest in life had been to study Anglo-Saxon architecture. And golly, he'd been doing so since the 30s. And he and his then late wife had published, or were in the course of publishing, a series of great books called Anglo-Saxon Architecture. And we knew Harold very well. And he came to saw our excavations of the Anglo-Saxon cathedral at Winchester. And then we went to a conference in East Anglia, University of Norwich, I think it probably was. And Harold gave a paper, and he talked a lot about Repton. He said, well, I've been studying this for 30, 40 years, since 1936, I think, the year before I was born. And he still had lots and lots of problems. And Beata and I looked at each other as we sat there in the audience, and we said, well, you know, there are problems here that could be solved by archaeology, by some digging, and also by some very, very detailed recording, stone by stone, of the standing architecture, the standing walls of Repton Church. And so we said to Harold afterwards, well, what about it? Let's do a project together. And that's how it started. But it was like coming back home. I mean, I'd lived in the village in the war. I was delighted to go back. There were still people I'd been at school with around, and many people I knew and remember, my parents, who were by then both dead. So it was very happy indeed, actually.
Was there any stories like this when you were growing up of what was hiding there?
Well, there's always been stories about Repton. Repton, you know, is the site of one of those English so-called public schools, which are, in fact, of course, not public at all. They're very expensive.
Yeah, that's right.
and it's
nothing's
a very
for free.
One. Yeah, it's a very famous one. And I went to the kindergarten, which was the first stage of that school, kindergarten, preparatory school, and then the big school. I didn't go to that big school. I went to another one. But I went to the kindergarten there. And there were always all sorts of stories about Repton. There was St. Wiston or St. Wigstan, who was a saint buried in the crypt of the church, so they thought. And it was known that the Vikings had wintered at Repton in the 870s, but nobody knew anything about it. And then there was some very odd stories indeed of discoveries that had been made in the garden of the vicarage to the east of the church, a huge burial and all sorts of things. So, yes, there were lots of stories, but we didn't really know too much about those until we got going. And we really started off to do some digging near the church to try and establish what was the structural history of the building to help Harold in his study of its architecture.
And yeah, tell us what happened and how this unfolded. I know that there were some small burial mounds in the area related to it, which we can talk more about later. But obviously, this was nothing that you were intent on finding. So how did it unfold?
How absolutely right. No, in fact, nobody really believed what was written and said about the one burial mound we know of, which is to the west of the church. And we weren't thinking about doing anything there at all. We went there to use archaeology to study the architectural development of the church. And so we started off in the summer of 1974. We just did a couple of weeks, I think, then, and in 75 and 76. And then things began to get quite interesting because in our excavations at the east end of the church is still standing. It's still in use today, and the Anglo-Saxon work stands to roof level at the east end of the church in the area of the chancel. Is in fact Anglo-Saxon building right up to the roof, 30 feet high. And we were excavating there, and we found very, very complicated archaeology. Very complicated. One, it's very important to know that the Anglo-Saxon east end of Repton Church is not only Anglo-Saxon up to about 30 feet above the ground, but it sits on an Anglo-Saxon crypt, the vault of which is supported by four twisted columns and is one of the most important Anglo-Saxon buildings to survive from England before the Norman conquest. So there was a tremendous amount to interest Harold and a tremendous amount to interest us. But we started excavating outside to the south of the crypt and gradually began to establish the relationship between a whole sequence of burials outside the church and the construction of the crypt itself. And it all became extremely complicated. But there were important finds known from there. In the 1920s, a master at the school had actually recorded the discovery of an iron axe in a trench that he dug, I suppose for sort of archaeological purposes, outside the south side of the crypt. And that axe was very clearly not an ordinary axe. The shape of it was quite typical of the Viking period, if not particularly Viking itself, but I think it probably was. And that was odd. And we were able to identify which burial that had come from. He dug a trench. He wasn't an archaeologist. He just dug a trench outside the walls of the church and didn't know what he was doing. He couldn't have done. But we did find the rest of that grave, and we found where the axe had come from. And it was quite an interesting grave. And then excavating a little further east, still immediately outside the east end of the church, we began to find a very deep cut in the ground. I mean, a very deep cut in the ground. And it emerged that eventually, I mean, it took some time to dig it. it emerged that we had touched the corner of a very deep V-shaped ditch, about 5 meters wide, 6 meters wide, perhaps at the top, about 4 meters deep. I mean, that's a jolly big ditch, you know, 16 feet deep, 20 feet wide, which came up to the southeast corner of the crypt and stopped. And the end of the ditch was in line with the east face of the crypt and the chancel. And the north side of the ditch was in line with the south face of the crypt and the chancel. We thought to ourselves, my golly, that's odd. What on earth is happening? It looks as though that ditch has been dug in relation to the standing Anglo-Saxon church. And that's exactly what proved to be the case. And so we had to decide, well, how are we going to trace this? Where does this ditch run? Mind you, you were working in no boys there, of course, it was in the holidays always when we dug it. And we were right in the school yard. And so the only way to do it, to find out, really, was to use one of these electrical resistivity methods.
Right.
And we got a very fine team from Bradford University in. And I'll never forget that when the plots of their careful measurements of the resistance of the ground to the passage of an electric current for the area of to the east of the Anglo-Saxon church, it's very complicated at Repton, the east of the Anglo-Saxon church, there was in fact a 12th century monastery. And it was in the courtyard of that monastery, which is now a main part of the school, that they were doing this survey. And right across it, they traced out the line of this ditch we'd found. And it ran away from where we'd found it, and it began to curve in a great sweep northwards towards the River Trent, on the bank of which all this, the church and the school, sit. And it was astonishing. I mean, there was this really very big ditch ending at the church, running away from the church eastwards, and then curving around northwards, quite clearly to end on the bank of what had been the old course of the river. And that was exciting enough. And then we thought, well, we'd better see what happens on the other side of the church. Does the ditch start again? And it did. And although that particular kind of survey was quite difficult, we used a proton magnetometer, we did trace it, and we traced it well enough, we couldn't be quite sure, to see that it was running away from the church in the opposite direction and then curving again around to the north to come up against the south bank of what had been the river. And so when we found that a couple of years later, we did an excavation in the riverbank. There's a cliff there, 20 feet high, and there was the end of the ditch. So what we'd found was a D-shaped ditch, or shall we say a curving ditch, forming with the bank of the old River Trent forming the straight side, and then coming down from that southwards to look like a letter D.
Yeah.
It was a D-shaped ditch with the church at the crown of the bow of the D, and with the river forming the north side. And my wife, Beata, was a Dane. That's why her name is Beata Kølbu. Beata Kølbu is a very famous Danish name.
Yeah.
And she had excavated, had been at the University of Aarhus, where she read archaeology, and she had excavated at the Danish city of Aarhus in Jutland. And that begins just in this way, as a D-shaped enclosure, great big ditch and bank enclosure, on the south side of, well, to use rather loosely a word, a fjord, which is the core of the modern city of Aarhus. And indeed, inside that D-shaped ditch is the cathedral. So we, becoming pretty well aware that something pretty serious was happening at Repton, we knew that the Viking Great Army had wintered at Repton in 873-4, because there's a passage in Old English in what we call the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which is a series of entries year by year, very complicated in origin and subject to much discussion. But in the year for which we can tell is 873, it said that the great Viking Great Army took winter settle. Well, settle is obvious, it's our word, settle. They took their winter settlement at Repton.
Mm.
So we had a clue But when we started digging at Repton in 74, we had no idea we were going to contact the Vikings. I mean, nobody had ever found a Viking winter camp in Repton in England before.
So this was the first of its kind, really?
It was the first of its kind. We could guess that there were others, but none had been identified. And this was the first Viking winter camp to be found. And we knew who'd been there and when they'd been there in the years 873 to 4. But I suppose we started at Repton with other thoughts in our mind, but it became a very, very important Viking excavation. All kinds of discoveries followed this original identification of the enclosure that I've described.
Yeah, there's just a tremendous amount of interesting things here that we need to discuss and talk more about. One thing that I find curious, and this is how it goes, I guess, when you look back historically, things are written about and then forgotten and what have you, but there was previous work speculated as far back as, what, 1687 by Thomas Walker in the area, right?
Yes, my friend Thomas Walker. Yes, aged 80. Well, yes, but you see, nobody believed it. I mean, if I tell you the story, you'll see why they didn't believe it, because the chap who recorded it was a doctor in the early 18th century called Dr. Simon Degg, D-E-double-G-E. And he was a society doctor in London. He was well-trained for years. He'd studied at Leiden and places like that. And in the summer months, he went home to his home county of Derbyshire. And they had a townhouse in Derby. And I don't think he necessarily did much medicine during the summer. I think he did things that interested him. And two things interested him. One was antiquities, and one was gigantism and longevity. So three things, actually. And he and some friends rode out from Derby in the summer of, gosh, what was the date of it? I'm forgetting at the moment, precisely. It was, I think, 1727. I'm looking that up at the moment. I should remember that absolutely off the top of my head, but I don't remember it.
No worries.
And he rode out to Repton with some friends, and they asked for antiquities, and the villagers brought to Degg and his friends a very old man called Thomas Walker. And Thomas Walker said that many years ago, in cutting hillocks, I mean, levelling them, I suppose, in a close or a field near the church, he'd become across a stone structure, and that in digging it out, I can quote from it here, I think, probably, if I can find it rapidly, he'd found a stone structure, and within the structure, a massive deposit of human bones. And in the middle of those human bones, he'd found the stone-lined burial of forming a stone coffin, he said. He found a stone coffin. And I'm quoting now, with difficulty removing the cover, he saw a skeleton of a humane body 9 foot long.
Wow.
And round it lay 100 humane skeletons with their feet pointing to the stone coffin. Well, that's pretty odd. He opened the coffin, he took the head of the skeleton and gave it to one of the masters at the school, and Dr. Degg, the doctor who 50, 60 years later was talking about this, went and asked the son of that schoolmaster, who said, yes, I remember that. And he remembered that his father had often spoken about a gigantic corpse, and that the skull was in proportion to a body of that size. And he remembered various other things, that it was a building, a sunken building of stone, paved with broad flat stones, and in the wall was a door case and steps going down to us. And Degg spoke to several old people there, and they attested to this, and they'd likewise seen and measured the skeleton. Well, I mean, what on earth do you make of a story like that?
Yeah,
recorded by an old chap, I think probably a very intelligent man with a good memory, written down by a learned doctor who was also an antiquary. He was, in fact, the third director of the Society of Antiquaries in London, our second oldest learned society, founded in 1727. And he was also a fellow of the Royal Society, founded in 1660 odd. So Degg was a very intelligent man, and he published this in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. So we knew we had a contemporary record of it, but what did it mean? I mean, anybody believe it? What on earth had Walker seen? Degg didn't see any of the bones. He only had to rely on the son of the then previous headmaster of the school. So what on earth was it all about?
Yeah.
But there was a mound in the vicarage garden. And the vicarage is right beside the church to the west of it. And some people had dug into this mound in the 19th century. And they'd found again a great mass of human bone. And we thought, once we'd found the D-shaped ditch, we thought, well, we, you know, let's test this out. I mean, perhaps it's just the mound of a mill, you know, a post mill, sitting in the middle of it, the mill above it. I remember it as a child because there was a sycamore tree on top of it, a great big sycamore tree, which shaded a large part of the vicarage garden. And I can remember parties around that, I mean, tea parties, around that tree during the war, 1943, 45, something like that. And we did know that the lady of the manor who told Thomas Walker to fill it all in had told him to plant a tree on it. And he did. This wasn't the tree that survived. Sycamores don't live more than about 150 years or so. And by the time we started to dig there, the one I remember in the 40s was cut down, but basically it was there. Anyway, we put a trench into it, into the mound. And quite extraordinarily, we found that there was a mound. Well, you could see it on the grass surface of the vicarage garden, but I mean, it was quite clear it was a substantial mound of pebble. And we also found some stones, quite rough stones, but carefully laid out in a sort of curving line, which is the sort of thing we call a curb. And we thought, well, we'd better open that up. And the following year, we opened up the whole area of the mound, and we did indeed find a low mound of pebble with a sort of oval, really a rectangle, I suppose, with rounded corners, stone curb lying on top of it, marking it out, sort of staking the territory. And in the middle, we found that it had been dug into. And one of the diggings into it certainly was early 19th century. Of course, we found some bits of early 19th century China. But there was a much bigger excavation. And we gradually cleared that. And we found, in fact, a building, a stone building, under the mound. It with two rooms, quite a small stone building, but it was sunken. It wasn't just a stone building on the contemporary ground surface. It was sunken about 2.5 feet below the then ground surface. And it had been cut right down and the mound piled up over it. The eastern compartment, by the time we got there and other people had dug it in the 18th and a bit again in the 19th century, it was simply a rectangular compartment. But the western compartment was a smaller one, which if this were a chapel, it would be the chancel end, was cut off from the rest by a wall with a central doorway. And in there was a huge mass of human bone.
Yeah.
It was all over the place. I mean, when we first saw it, we couldn't make any sense of it. It was quite clearly disturbed, as indeed Thomas Walker's account suggested it probably was. He dug it all over. So we recorded it very carefully. We cleaned everything. We photographed it all from we made friends with a local major roadworks contractor who who loaned us one of those wonderful cranes with a great big electric arm, which will go up 40 or 50 feet so we could take photographs looking down on it. We've got those marvelous photographs of this. And we cleaned it all up and planned it very, very carefully. And then we started to empty the eastern compartment of the human bone. And we sieved absolutely everything, quite apart from picking out the bones we saw. We sieved everything. We got 5,000 small mammal bones, you know.
Wow.
Well, or frog and, I mean, small mammals, rats and mice, but also frog and all that sort of thing. And tiny fragments, only a few, but tiny fragments of precious stuff, of gold, silver.
Mm-hmm.
We also found an axe and two great iron short swords. They're called saxes, S-E-A-X.
Yes.
They have a thick back and a thin edge. And we found fragments of those. And then in the far northeast corner, we found that some of the bones had not been disturbed by Thomas Walker. And they were lying very neatly. They were long bones. They were stacked rather like matches in a matchbox, very carefully. And it became quite clear to us what Thomas Walker had seen. He'd seen a room with stacked bones in it, like you do sometimes see even today in medieval charnel houses. And in the middle, he'd found presumably a stone-built grave. We didn't find any of that in position. And we didn't find any of the bones that might have been part of the gigantic corpse in that. But it all was consistent with what Walker said. And in those, among those bones, we found five silver pennies. And four of those can be dated. They don't carry dates, but learned numismatists have worked out the dating of these. Four of them were dated to sort of 872 to 3. But one of them was just a little bit later, something like 873 to 4. And so this deposit, which, although it had been turned over in the 18th century and to some extent in the 19th century, was not contaminated. There was the odd piece of post or late medieval roof tile, the odd piece of 17th and 19th century pottery, but that's the sort of thing people might have dropped while they were, you know, digging it up. But otherwise, it was quite uncontaminated. And there can be no doubt, I think, that what we were dealing with was a massive bone deposit placed in the eastern compartment of this two-roomed sunken building. Mm. Stacked charnel-wise, we call it, when bones are stacked carefully next to each other and then perhaps the lot above them at right angles, and with the skulls on top. Stacked charnel-wise. And then the building, either before or then, cut down to about ground level, and the whole thing covered with a mound. And the mound marked out with a curb of broken stones lying on top of it. You know, this is sacred ground. Don't walk on this, as it were.
Right.
So we were able to make sense of this extraordinary story that Thomas Walker had told to Dr. Simon Digg in the 1740s. And it all fitted. So I think what we've got here is a major Viking period grave. There were the bones of at least 264 people in that deposit. Almost all of them male, I mean, apart from very few, almost all of them late teens, early 20s. Very, very few small bones. I mean,
yeah.
There should have been something like 14,000 bones of the hands and feet. We just got a few hundred. It's quite obvious the bodies had been gathered from somewhere after they'd decayed. They might have been buried and decayed and dug up and just the big bones brought. Or they might have lain out on a battlefield with the animals and so forth taking away the small bones. I rather think they were probably buried and they just collected the big bones, the long bones, the skull bones, the leg bones, the arm bones, you know, the backbone, that sort of thing. And that the dating evidence was that this had been closed in exactly the years when the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle told us the Vikings had wintered at Repton.
Yeah.
So this was really quite an extraordinary find. I mean, there has been nothing else like it since. There have been other individual Viking burials. Indeed, there was to be a very important Viking burial we haven't talked about, actually beside the church at Repton, to the east of the church, where we'd begun digging some years before. And important Viking burials of that kind, usually single, there's some of them known. But nothing like this deposit at Repton has ever been seen before. And of course, the big question is, how do you interpret it? We've got a date.
Well, yeah.
You know, it's very difficult. And we could go on to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, let's do that. There are so many fascinating aspects here. And I mean, what were you, I guess I'd just like to ask, what were you thinking at the time? And when did you kind of begin to connect the dots, I guess, in terms of what you were finding? And I don't know if this was over a long period of time, a couple of years, or if it was fairly short that these finds were made.
No, the first Viking finds were actually made in the first season of Repton in 1974, because then we discovered this grave, which had been cut into without recognizing it by the schoolmaster in 1924 or so, from which he got a Viking-type axe.
Right, yeah.
So we knew there was something happening. Then the next year, perhaps, or at the latest in 1976, we found the end of this ditch curving away from the church. And we used the scientific methods to trace it out to east and west and realized we got a D-shaped enclosure. And then we realized that the mound in the vicarage garden was outside the enclosure. And so we carried out that excavation and we reached the point of good dating evidence. We had no dating evidence really for the ditch at all. There were a few, two or three fragments of pottery of the right date in it. So it fitted perfectly well with a Viking interpretation, which his whole character suggested it could only be. But no good dating evidence until we got these coins from the mass bone deposit in the mound in the vicarage garden.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we were face to face with the fact that we'd got an absolutely believable entry in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle relating to the years 873-4. And we had got a major archaeological discovery, which could be dated by totally independent evidence of the coins, having nothing to do with the written evidence at all, to the same period. And then we realized we're really faced with a really major Viking discovery.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really great when we get, we shouldn't call them rumors perhaps, but myths to a certain extent, especially when we consider some of the finds of the giant, or whatever we want to call him here in this picture as well. But when reality comes and archaeology comes in touch with these stories and make it real in that sense, it's just magnificent. How did you begin to, I don't know if there's many other people who probably have been involved in this, all the finds, doing maybe their own interpretation, maybe working officially with you guys and what have you, but how did you go about piecing together the story of what happened here, correlating the different information, both, as you said, from the chronicles, but also then looking maybe at even sagas themselves about how certain things were said where these Vikings were, yeah, at the time, right?
Well, there is, of course, a lot of what one might call secondary literature, which has been discussing these things. The chronicles have all been properly edited by great scholars. Of course, I had a great advantage that my wife was a Dane and was absolutely brought up with Danish archaeology, and had excavated herself as a student on the D-shaped defences of the Danish city of Aarhus, where her university was. So, and had known from childhood about Viking burials with stone settings, sometimes, for example, in the shape of ships.
That's right, yeah. Visited one just a couple of months ago. Yeah, they're great.
Yeah. And so we were pretty alert to this, and we really had no problem dealing with the contemporary texts in whatever language they were, and also keeping abreast of the critical scholarship about the reliance or otherwise that might be placed upon them. And we did our own documentary research. You know, we read the documents that Dr. Simon Degg had left. We looked at the early numbers of the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society and transcribed them ourselves. copied them ourselves. So it really was very much our thing. But we were very lucky because from the very, well, I say lucky, I mean, Bertrand and I had done a very big excavation at Winchester from 64 when we met on to 1970 of the Anglo-Saxon Cathedral at Winchester with very large numbers of burials. We were absolutely used to the problems of burial archaeology and to its difficulties in interpretation and how it should be recorded. Therefore, one of our top priorities was to excavate with the greatest possible care the burials we were finding east of the church. Now, I mentioned to you that we did find the burial that he hadn't recognized, which the schoolmaster had found in the 1920s and from which he'd got an iron axe. But we found some other things. To the north of the church, we found a burial of a man with a gold ring of a kind which is found on Viking sites in Scandinavia, and again, coins, datable again to the 870s. Tucked right up against the wall of the earliest part of the church. And then a little bit away from that wall, in 1976, when we were, of course, also working in the vicarage garden, we began to get a rectangular setting of broken stone. Now, when I say a setting, I don't mean simply a rectangle about 6 foot by 6 foot marked out with the edges marked out, but I mean really a little cairn, a little square cairn of broken stone.
Right.
Some of them, bits of broken Anglo-Saxon crosses, I may say. somebody been bashing them up.
Right.
Now, underneath that stone, a setting, which we'd recorded with great care, we hadn't recognized what it was as we, with really immense care, excavated down. But we had full records, it was all photographed, all drawn, all described. Underneath it, we found two graves. One of those graves is one of the most remarkable ever found from Viking England. It was of a man lying on his back with a necklace with glass beads and a silver hammer of the god Thor, T-H-O-R, around his neck. With a sword beside his left leg, with a couple of knives with the sword, and with, when we lifted, having recorded the burial and recorded the scabbard, the sword, which is still in its scabbard, incidentally, but of course all really turned to iron decay products from the iron of the sword, we found that an immense cut had been hacked, there's no other word for it, into the inside of his left thigh bone. It's a V-shaped cut. It must, I think, have been done. It can't have been done by a Scramus axe. It's too light a weapon. Probably done by an axe by someone standing on top of him and hacking down, facing towards his feet and simply hacking down. And, of course, castrating him.
Right, yeah.
A massive cut. And where his penis would have been was a boar's tusk lying precisely in that position. The body was very tightly laid. It must have been wrapped. It was very carefully laid out. He had his necklace of the hammer of the Thor. He had the sword and the various other items beside him. And this is clearly a Viking warrior burial. The Thor's hammer, of course, is clear evidence of that. He'd been very badly damaged in fighting. That was by no means the end of his wounds. He'd been stabbed through the eyes, all sorts of other problems.
Wow.
But he'd been very carefully buried. And beside him was the burial of another man, younger, very badly preserved, no finds, but laid out beside him, and both of them together covered by this square stone setting. And I think what we've got here is we've got a Viking warrior with his, with his servant, if you like.
That's right.
With his Batman, if you like, to use a modern term, beside him, who'd both been killed together. And they'd recovered the bodies, and the Vikings who had the church, which they were clearly using as a strong point in their D-shaped earthwork, had buried them together under this setting. So, I mean, we were, by this time, we were deep in Viking archaeology.
Yeah.
Deep. And although I've now recounted most of the major finds from Repton, everything fits with a Viking winter camp in the winter of 873-4, with the male nature of that community, very few women indeed, nearly all young men of military age in that great burial in the mound. And then there was the question, how are we going to interpret this? Well, we came to the conclusion, again, Beata knew lots about the habits of Vikings, that they always tried to bring their dead back. You may remember that Eric the Red was killed somewhere in what might be North America.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And was brought back to the Viking settlement on Greenland. A special expedition, I think I'm right in saying, was sent out to find him. There are other stories, too, of people who were buried in winter and were kept, as it were, in dead houses in the ice, which would protect them, of course, before being moved later, perhaps, to places of burial. And we thought about this. We thought about why are there the bones of some 260 people in which the little bones are simply missing?
Yeah.
And as I mentioned earlier, we came to the conclusion they must have been dug up from somewhere else, perhaps from several different places elsewhere, and brought together to be buried around somebody who was in this central tomb that Thomas Walker ransacked, at a date which is defined by the coins, as also by the very different evidence of the writings in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. So we're dealing here with both the wintering of a Viking great army and the doubtless fighting going on and the chap with his sword being buried by the church and so on, but also with a distinctive effort of bringing together a large number of people who'd been dug up from somewhere else, because otherwise the small bones would be there.
Yeah.
Why weren't they there? Well, because basically, of course, if they'd lain out on the field of battle, the small bones might have been taken away by animals. Much more likely, I think, they were probably mass buried. And when they dug them up, they just didn't bother. And we found a very interesting case of that. Because after the Vikings' army had left, the mound with these burials in it had obviously remained of very great interest to the local people, presumably Viking settlers. And they began to bury their dead into the top of the mound.
Ah, adding on to it, yeah.
Adding on to it. There were not weapon burials, but they were pretty important burials, sometimes in iron-bound coffins. And in some cases, later, the bodies had been removed. I think of one case in particular, which is relevant to this discussion we're having. Because we emptied the grave, we found nothing in the grave until we excavated the feet. And there were the feet. In other words, people had come along at a later date, dug up this person, presumably he was marked by a wooden marker or a stone marker, and they wanted to put him somewhere else. Probably by then they were Christian, and they wanted to move him to a church or to a church.
Right, because that's one of the things I was thinking about here. But at least what we hear from some of the stories, we know that a classic Viking burial is cremation on a ship, preferably, at least if it's a chieftain.
Well, that's a really classic one.
Yeah, yeah. You know, but in this case we're talking about what seems to be more of a Christian burial to a certain extent. So is there, maybe we're right in that overlap time here perhaps or something, and as you said, either they were reburied later in a Christian fashion or something maybe.
Well, I think actually probably if we but knew it, most of the population of Denmark at that time had been buried in cemeteries, not yet Christian cemeteries, but in pagan cemeteries, in burials. And it would be quite normal to do that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So what was abnormal, of course, was this mass burial of this huge quantity of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of bones, with the small bones missing. And when we excavated this later burial, which had been cut into the top of the mound and found no body but only two marvellous pairs of feet in position, we had an exact example of the fact that they didn't really bother very much about the bones. There's a wonderful poem by one of our war poets, whom I'm going to name forget at the moment, which is very stupid of me. And he wrote a poem called Only the Long Bones, Madam, Only the Very Long Bones. And that was published in The Listener, or the Radio Listener, I think, in the time we were doing this dig. And it's about a war widow who goes back to Burma seeking the grave of her husband and realizing that he'd been moved and brought into, you know, one of the War Graves Commission cemeteries. And she asks the Burmese custodian and gravedigger too there, well, what was left of him? Oh, only the long bones, madam, only the very long bones, not the fingers and toes. And
right.
There's a modern parallel.
Right, yeah.
So I think, though, when we get to these important Vikings, there's no doubt about that. These are important local Vikings being buried into the top of the Repton Mound, which they must have regarded, really, you know, as a sort of their foundation monument, really.
Yeah.
When we find some of those empty, only one or two were empty, the rest were allowed to stay there, then I think we're on the verge of them becoming Christian. And they're being dug up and they're being moved to, presumably, the part of the churchyard of Repton Church. And indeed, we have a Viking tombstone called a hogback tombstone. It's lost, unfortunately. It was recorded, drawn about 1800, but it's been lost from Repton Churchyard.
Right.
So there were graves marked in the Viking fashion, or at least one, but presumably others, in the churchyard. And I think we're on the edge of all this. The Vikings are, they're encountering Christianity. They're taking over the monastery at Repton, wrecking it, of course, building a ditch around it, using the church in the line of their defences, presumably as a stone gatehouse, and a place for eating and drinking and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But they're coming into close association with Christianity. And, you know, sometimes, though this doesn't relate to Repton, they actually looted, well, they looted the Repton Monastery, I don't question, but they actually sometimes took away very, very valuable illuminated manuscripts, and they ransomed them, and they had to be bought back. And there's a very famous one, I think it's called the Liber Aureus, or the Codex Aureus, which actually has an inscription in it saying how it had been bought back from the Vikings.
Oh, really? Oh, interesting.
So that sort of thing's happening. We're right on the edge of lots of change.
Yeah.
Social change, religious change. And Repton stands as an extraordinary monument to what happened.
Now, let's talk a little bit more about the giant here. I think some people who caught that, we need to talk a little bit about that here. And of course, who that was. And I mean, we have the stories of Ivar Ragnarsson, or Ivar the Boneless, as he's also known, one of the sons of Ragnar Lothbrok. So
that's right.
Tell us about this find and who this is, potentially.
Well, I'm reading again now here from what Simon Digg wrote down after Simon Walker, after he talked to Thomas Walker. And he said, Walker said he found a stone coffin with difficulty removing the cover. He saw a skeleton of humane body, 9 foot long, as we said before, and around it lay 100 humane skeletons with their feet pointing to the stone coffin. They seemed to be of the ordinary size. The head of the great skeleton he gave to Mr. Bowers, master of the free school, and I, that's Dr. Digg, inquired of his son, one of the present masters, concerning it, but he's lost. And he says he remembers the skull in his father's closet, and that he'd often heard his father mention this gigantic corpse, and thinks this skull was in proportion to a body of that stature. And this was attested to us by several people who'd likewise seen and measured the skeleton. I've excavated, and the people working with me have excavated very many skeletons. And I remember when we were excavating a medieval cemetery under King Henry VIII's Nonsuch Palace near Ewell in Surrey. Henry VIII cleared away a village, including the village church, and built his palace on top of the church and cemetery. And we excavated about 100 skeletons from that as part of a Cambridge University research project when we were all undergraduates, and we did that in 1959. And one of the commonest things that visitors said, and this was one of the sort of extraordinary moments in British archaeology, we had 75,000 visitors visited that site in the 10 weeks of our excavation of one of Henry's palaces. One of the things that come, they're oohini long. Mm-hmm. And when people look down at a skeleton lying in the ground, where the head has probably fallen backwards, where the feet have fallen down forwards, and where they're looking at an angle anyway, they think they're very big. And this is an absolute commonplace. And it doesn't mean they're any bigger than normal. But people said that time and time again. And I'm sure that that's right about Repton. It's just a way people have of describing skeletons when they're lying out in the ground. And it doesn't really mean they were 9 foot long or anything like that at all. A big chap, yeah, perhaps. Some of the femurs, I mean, I'm 6 foot two. Some of the femurs from that excavation were very big indeed.
I saw them. I mean, I saw them, I forget which one. I think it was the Discovery Channel. It might even have showed up in Blood of the Vikings, the BBC documentary, where,
yes, that's right,
where,
yes,
you actually hold the femur. I mean, it's enormous. I mean,
yes. Well, it's you know, it's as big as a femur I've got.
All right. Okay.
As I say, I'm 6 foot two.
Right.
One of my uncles was 6 foot six. One of my sons-in-law is 6 foot six and a half. I mean, you know, they have got very, very big femurs, I can tell you.
When do you have Viking blood in you then? So.
That's not impossible. Yeah. My name, Beadle, which is Old English for a policeman.
Oh, there you go.
This I was on the other side.
Right. Has there been any work done then on the skeletons?
Yes. A huge amount of work has been done with my friend and colleague Dr. Bob Stoddart, who used to be associate dean of the medical school at the University of Manchester and spent a great deal of his career at Cambridge at Sidney Sussex. We have done a complete study of all the human remains from Repton, not only of the hundreds of individual bones from the burial mound that we've talked a lot about, which might of course include one or other bones from that great central body, we'll never know, one or two very, very big femurs, so it's possible. But we've also, Bob has also done a very, very full investigation of all the several hundred burials excavated around the church. And we have a book, which we have really just about finished, on the burials from Repton, which is going to deal with all the burials we excavated, whether they be part of the monastery or part of the Viking occupation or part of the later occupation of the site. And so, yes, we have done a tremendous amount of work on that. And we have actually published already quite a lot of it in quite a detailed form in an article that we published as long ago as 2001, which you've probably read. Repton and the Great Heathen Army, 873 to 874.
That's right. I have it right in front of me as we speak.
Yeah. Well, we've published a great deal in there, and there's a lot about the Viking burials. In fact, almost everything you and I have talked about today is in there one way and another. But now we have a really big book coming out with all the detailed statistical and physiological anthropological evidence for the skeletal material. Tremendous amount of work.
Well, excellent. What can you say about the finds? And does it tell us anything about, you know, how they lived or what have you, or what type of life they maybe had as soldiers in this army?
Well, I mean, of course, we are dealing with several different populations. You understand?
Yes.
We've got this,
yes,
intrusive Viking population. And we've got what we must regard as the local population, though doubtless the later members of that are a mixture. I mean, the fact that people were burying their dead in the top of the mound later on suggests that there's Viking settlement that looks back to that mound, as I mentioned, sort of as to, you know, its foundation document. So they'll be into marriage and all sorts of things going on. But we have indeed studied them. And now we've got some very interesting work being done by Dr. Kat Jarman of the University of Bristol on the isotopes of some of the burials. And the markers are beginning to look very much as if we're dealing with certainly some of the burials from the mound, or some of the bones from the mound, with a population that's coming. Well, it looks as though they're coming from the east side of the Oslo Fjord, and the part that's, where modern Sweden reaches up to.
Right.
And this is all very preliminary. We've done a Kat has done a what they call it, a paper display at one of the conferences, but we're working towards an article now on her particular aspect of this. We've got masses of radiocarbon dates, by the way. I haven't really gone into that. It's been very, very, I mean, in this discussion, we have a very large number of radiocarbon dates, and everything is fitting with the dating suggested by the coins and by the documentary evidence. So with regard to the mound burial, I think that's tied up pretty well. Of course, given that there's the remains of 264 people in that mound, we haven't had the resources to do more than a very small, relatively small number of bones. But the results appear, Kat tells me, to be looking consistent. So we're getting a background to that, and we should be able to say things about diet. If we can get on, we have had some work done on the teeth, so we may be able to get some information about where some of these people were brought up because of the signature in the permanent dentition, which has already been affected by groundwater before, when they still got their baby teeth. So there's a lot more to come. The book on the skeletal material as such, I do hope we're not more than a year away from finishing that. But the scientific evidence will go on being studied for ages, I think.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Although I'm very glad to say that all the human bone material is in the National Anthropological Collection, National Human Remains Collection, in the care of the British Museum, of the Natural History Museum.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You just so many finds and everything. And tell us just how big the enclosure were for those who just want to get a little bit of an image of what happened here. And obviously, as you said, to clarify again, the riverbank was at a different place. We've had consequently, it's moved what, half a mile, I think, away. Or
Oh yes, the riverbank has moved indeed. Yes, half a mile or so away. The air, but of course, what happens is that the D-shaped enclosure that we've got terminates in its two north ends at the old bank of the river, which is quite high, five or 6 meters high.
yeah.
And the oval, well, not the oval, but the D shape encloses, well, in new money, 1.6 hectares, but I suppose people might like to know that that's 3.65 acres.
Right.
So it's not enormous, but in a famous drawing on the front of that article I've been mentioning, it's enough for, at least three Viking longships to tie up on the river frontage below that D-shaped earthwork. And if they had several tied up together, you could have half a dozen or more there. So it's not a camp for tens of thousands of men,
Right,
but
yeah.
it's a very strongly defended enclosure, with the church apparently used as, I used the word gatehouse earlier. But of course, I imagine that the nave of the church and so on, and any monastic buildings that were then standing, could be used as accommodation, great halls for eating and feasting, perhaps. It wants to be very romantic. And there'd be tented camps and so forth inside. We have made some effort to try and find those, but we didn't, for a very good reason, that the one area, the headmaster's kitchen garden, where we actually could excavate on a large scale within the enclosure, half of it is a churchyard, half of it's a school. But under the headmaster's kitchen garden, we started a very big excavation. And what we found was an enormous cut. I mean, colossal cut in the ground, full of earth, backfilled. And we were so enthused by this, right in the middle of the Viking D-shaped enclosure, that we thought it was what is called a naust, an N-A-U-S-T, which, if you like, is a kind of dry dock for pulling up a Viking longship.
Oh, really? Hmm.
And when we were still thinking that's what it might be, we actually, one of our chaps who was working with us, actually made a magnificent cross-section of one of the great Viking ships, painted full size and painted red. And we popped it in this trench, took a photograph of it. Everybody was absolutely convinced that this is what it was until we dug further the next season. And then my wife and I began to notice that the naust wasn't straight. It curved. Hmm. And that became a bit worrying. There were desperate attempts to say it was a naust for a banana boat.
Right.
It didn't go down very well. It was part of the ditch of a 12th century Motton Bailey castle that had been built on the same site three centuries later. And the funny thing was, actually, the very funny thing was that I remember in the second season of that excavation, two, I'm not going to name them, very, very distinguished English medieval historians, great friends of mine, and they absolutely loved the idea that this was a Viking naust. And when I said, but I'm awfully sorry, you can see it's curving. We can't believe that anymore. We think it's a lost castle of the Earls of Chester. We had reason for that. I mean, the Earls of Chester did own this site later, and the widow of one of them founded Repton Monastery on the site. And they have a line of castles right across the Midlands, from Chester to Lincoln, linking their ancestral lands. And there wasn't one in the Repton area, and this was it. But those historians, they didn't want to believe that. I'm afraid it was. And then in the end, in the bottom of it, we found a very, very nice Norman shield boss.
Right.
No doubt that the naust hit the dust and the castle came. That's how things go on. You don't know what you're going to find.
Yeah.
Except in the broadest.
And it's easy to project onto things what you want it to be, of course. you know.
Well, it's not so much what you want it to be. I mean, I think all the time you're thinking, first of all, that what you're after is the evidence. But secondly, can you, as an ongoing story, make sense of the evidence?
Sure, yeah.
And we made sense of the evidence of the Viking D-shaped fortress. And that did turn out to be right, and there's no doubt about that. But we were sadly misled by the Norman castle.
Now, let me ask you, how do you, and might be a difficult question, and but I'm thinking about how they made it so far in there. We have the River Trent, of course, going into, at the time, the heart of Mercia, maybe?
Oh, yes.
And, of course, we have an inlet up by, further up north-east at Grimsby and Hull. There's an inlet there. Do you think that's the way they came there?
I think they came in down the Trent, yes. The year before, you know, they wintered at Torksey, which is in Nottinghamshire, about 25 miles downriver from Repton.
Okay, yeah.
And Torksey is a most extraordinary site because metal detecting at Torksey, it's not got a school on the front of it, it's open fields. And so metal detectorists, very responsible ones, have been working that site now for years, and there have been a couple of absolutely major academic articles recently about the hundreds of finds of coins and bits of silver and bits of gold and weights and so forth that are being found there. Now, that's typical of the kind of things you find on a Viking trading site. We got a lot of finds at Repton, but nothing like that. Now, what would happen if Repton was just under fields and you could go over it inch by inch with metal detectors? Of course, who can tell? But we did excavate quite a lot of it, and we didn't have that range of finds. We had remarkable number, but nothing like that. So there is a Viking winter camp of the previous winter downriver from Repton at Torksey. And they came up to Repton, and we do rather wonder whether Repton was a bit different. I mean, we are right in the heartland of Mercia, Repton. We have Mercian kings buried in the church, a very important monastery, which there wasn't at Torksey. And one wonders whether this was not exactly an outpost, but a firm stamping of Viking control not on Tamworth, which they could have gone up to, but on Repton, which was one of their important and very wealthy sites.
Yeah.
Something like that, I think, is the sort of story that one should be thinking about.
So we have the aspect from the stories that they camped there over the winter, of course, but as you said, this might mean that there was more permanent settlement there as well later on, and the people...
Well, of course it could.
Yeah.
And of course it could mean the Viking winter camp's not very big. I've said how many acres it is.
Yeah.
They could have camped outside it and only have disappeared inside the defences, which the church so conveniently gave them a strong point for, if they knew the Mercian army was coming up against them. We've no knowledge of fighting at Repton, so can't say whether that was the case or not.
Yeah. Have you thought anything further in terms of who it might been here? If there was a great Viking chieftain that was buried here?
Yes, yeah. Yes, we have indeed, because we do know who the Vikings were at Repton that winter. Three very important Vikings who were leaders of the great Danish army. And I'm just trying briefly to remember their names at the moment.
No worries.
Yes, Halfdan, Guthrum, and Oskettle, and Anwend are the four who are named in the annal, which refers to 873-4. Guthrum, who went, of course, south to Cambridge, Halfdan eventually went north to York, Oskettle and Anwend. And they all left Repton in the autumn of 874, and therefore none of them can be the man in the Repton mound, because the coins show that that belongs, as I've said, rather precisely to the years 873-4. But this was the great Danish army that had entered East Anglia in 875, and there was traditionally another leader. And that was Ivar Beinlaus, or Ivar Beinlösi. Now, he left Repton to go north to Dumbarton, and probably about 870, and sailed to Dublin in 871. So he didn't get to Repton. He must have left at an earlier stage from the Great Army. And he died in 873. Now, that's recorded in the Irish Annals of Ulster. And it's all been loosely assumed that he died at Dublin, but in fact it doesn't say so. And we don't know where he died. But he was one of the leaders of the great army that had campaigned together for nearly 10 years. And there's a good deal of saga evidence. Ragnar Lothbrok's saga, for example, tells that Ivar was buried in England in the manner of former times, is the quote.
Right.
And other parts of that discussion says in a barrow. And it's also clear that barrow is sited on a boundary. Well, it was my wife, steeped, of course, in Viking archaeology and Viking history, reading all this and knowing the care with which the Vikings took to bring their dead back to some secure place, put forward the suggestion in a rather remarkable lecture in the National Museum in Copenhagen with all the leading Danish archaeologists, colleagues and contemporaries and older ones than her there, that it was really very possible that the great burial recorded by Thomas Walker, well, recorded by Degg, as told to him by Thomas Walker, in the centre of this thing, was in fact perhaps Ivar the Boneless.
Yeah.
And to our surprise, I think, that has not been seriously attacked. I think there are those who don't believe it, and they might well be right. All we can point to is the fact that we have a fifth leader of the Great Army. The Great Army campaigned together for the last season in 873-4 at Repton, and then it split. As you know, Halfdan going north to York and Guthrum going south to Cambridge and then on to Wessex.
Yeah.
It's just the kind of moment when they might have brought together a lot of their dead from maybe quite a lot of different battlefields and buried them in a mound, or buried them actually in a cut down stone chapel, which was turned into the chamber tomb of a mound, and might, wherever he actually died, have brought their missing leader, Ivar the Boneless, to be buried in and at the centre of that same mound with his former companions. It is very interesting that Ragnar Lothbrok's saga does talk about the burial of Ivar, being, which he doesn't locate, being sited on a boundary, because, of course, the River Trent, which is the boundary of the Repton site to the north and flowed right under the Repton camp in those days, now, as you said earlier, a kilometre or more away to the north, that is one of the great boundaries of medieval England. I mean, the organisation of the English medieval forests was divided between the forests this side of Trent and that side of Trent, which must be a very, very ancient division indeed. And it is really the northern boundary of Mercia, too. If you look at the pagan Saxon archaeology of the area, the people who live in the Peak District, the Peachsetan, have different burial customs and different kinds of jewellery and so forth to those who are buried south of Trent. So it's quite a strong case that can be made that this very remarkable Repton burial of just the right date, reflecting really all just the right kind of customs that the Vikings seem to have gone in for, could indeed be the burial of Ivar the Boneless. It's a good case.
It is a good case, and I think this, of course, would explain, as you said before, about why the small bones are missing, and this might have been they might have been gathered at this place. And of course, it's very difficult to know. All right, was this done for strategic purposes? Were they busy with, you know, other things, or was it chosen for some other reason, perhaps?
Difficult to know. Repton was the burial church of Mercian kings.
Right.
And Ethelbald, the great ruler of Mercia, who died in 757, was buried in the crypt at Repton, outside which this Viking with his sword and his terrible wound had been buried. And indeed, Wiglaf, another Mercian king, was buried there, and so was Wistan. So this is a, and earlier on, the stories of at least one other Mercian king. It's a royal monastery, and they might well have taken the view that this, actually it was, one of the crucial places. They didn't get Tamworth. I mean, whether it was just too far in, or whether they just didn't have the power to get it, or they reckoned that Tamworth would be too strongly defended. They didn't get Tamworth, and they didn't get Lichfield, but they did get Repton, which, as I say, was a wealthy royal monastery. It was wealthy. They must have got a lot of loot, and they took it over, and in a sense, I think they made it their own. So I think there's a context for a burial of a very important Viking leader, surrounded by those who campaigned with him, who could be brought in from maybe several other sites and were simply dug up after several years in the ground, and they didn't bother about the little bones. It didn't matter.
Yeah.
They're not archaeologists, after all.
So they're kind of as a veneration.
The long bones, you know, the
right,
big bones.
Right, and as a veneration to their ancestors, they've realized the importance of them. They wanted to do something in that capacity, perhaps.
Yes. I mean, I think the whole Repton burial, which is extraordinary, I mean, there is nothing else known like it, certainly not in the British Isles, and indeed nothing on this scale at all, either in Scandinavia, to my knowledge. Of course, we're not talking about later massive boat burials like Oseberg.
Sure, so.
We're talking about this particular mound with this very particular fact of taking over an Anglo-Saxon Christian building that was sunk in the ground and therefore probably was itself a burial church, burial chapel, and might indeed possibly have been an Anglo-Saxon royal burial chapel rather than necessarily all the burials being in the crypt.
Yeah.
Taking that over, turning it into, cutting it down to ground level, turning it into the stone chamber, as it were, of the mound, covering it quite clearly, very carefully, with stones and apparently with timber, And it looks as though some of the timbers were still surviving when Thomas Walker dug into it in 1686. So they cut this building down. They actually made a very special case of this small eastern chamber. It might well have been a burial chamber, because they brought in red Kuiper loam. You get this green and red Kuiper in the area of Repton. They somehow found a vein of this red clay. They brought it in, and there's a bed about 6 to 9 inches thick, with which the whole of the eastern chamber was floored. And it was on top of that, without anything intervening, that they built their bone stacks and presumably their central burial, of which Walker removed all traces. So the whole picture, I mean, I do think it's a good case that they are taking over something that has significant Anglo-Saxon heritage, as it were. They're the new people coming in. They've conquered the locals. They're turning this into a burial place in which they gather together those of their comrades who'd fallen over the previous years and brought in the greatest leader of the Viking Great Army of 865, who himself had died at almost exactly that time. Where, we don't know. Maybe he was buried in Ireland, but nobody says he was. He may have come back to Repton. He may have died at Repton. We just simply do not know. And I think, as with the story of Richard III, which you allude to earlier, the question you have to ask for the written sources is, what do they not say? And absolutely vital. The sources about Richard do not say who else might have been buried in that chapel at Leicester, as well as Richard, who might have some of the same kind of characteristics. Nobody is raising that question. The criticism of sources, as it's called amongst quote, us professionals, has really been of a very low order of competence. Sorry, I'm saying tough things, but it's
No,
just.
no problem at all. No, so it's very might very well be that this was also kind of a strategy to demoralize the enemy of sorts, of showing that mark, we're here, we're going to take over, and
Yeah,
therefore this
we're here,
important
we're going
side
to
of
stay.
yours. Yeah.
Yeah, we're here, we're going to stay. Here's our monument. This is ours, we hold it. And I think burials are very important in this. I mean, the whole question of Richard III, of course, is extremely complicated and difficult one. But I mean, if you look at the burials of Anglo-Saxon kings, many of them, of course, at Winchester, but by no means all of them, they are very, very closely related in most cases to churches they've founded, or churches which are the centre of their kingdom, or churches which are being built specially for them, like the new minster at Winchester, built for Alfred and his wife by their son Edward the Elder. The place where people is buried is very important.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. Well, this it's just very interesting, you know. And how do you feel in terms of how much more work there is to discover about this site and related things? Is this just continuing? I mean, how many years have you spent working on this now? Many, many years.
Oh, well, we excavated at Repton from 1974 to 1980. 8 or 89, I can't remember. And then we had a number of working seasons there. And of course, my wife and I were involved in many other great projects, one of them in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, another one in Egypt, and principally in our work on the Anglo-Saxon Cathedral at Winchester. And so the problem, of course, is getting all this published. We've written a lot about Repton, and I'll say there's a book really very near now about some of the most important aspects of it. But certainly not for me alone, or anybody else, I think. And I'm not sure really it would be possible to go on digging at Repton. And you're not going to be able to dig in the churchyard itself. The circumstances were very unique when we excavated, because the eastern end of the church projected into the school grounds and therefore was not part of the present churchyard. Had it been, we would not been able to excavate there. So the greater part of what is around the church is under a churchyard, still in use. You can't go on digging there. There are other things that could be done, but the most important thing with Repta now is to get the whole thing fully published, and that is where the advances are going to be made, not only by us and our colleagues like Bob Stoddart, but by our younger colleagues like Kat Jarman, who's doing work with these modern scientific techniques on the material from Repta. So that's the next stage with Repta, getting the full publication finished, and then other techniques of which we don't really know anything now, which will be developed. And as I say, mercifully, the skeletal material is all in the care of the Natural History Museum and therefore in permanent public ownership.
Yeah. Now, I know you've written other books about your other work as well. We can certainly just name some of those later here as well to our listeners and audience. But do you know anything about the book that is about to be published or released, when and if, and publishers, etc., so people can look out for it once it's out?
Oh, it'll be published in a series called Investigations at Repton, and it will be number one in that series, and it will be published by RKO Press, which is in the office next to me here in Oxford.
I see.
They publish British Archaeological Reports, huge, very specialised, but they publish thousands of books. You can't believe it, but it's true.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more if there's anything else you feel. I mean, I know that there's a lot of details to talk about here, of course, but something you feel that's important to mention that we haven't gone into yet, either about the findings or about the site itself or about maybe your own thoughts or something like that about the work you've been doing on this.
Well, I think one of the sites is that really Repton is a quintessentially English place. I know we've been talking about Danes for most this conversation, but it's right in the heart of England. You can virtually not get further from the sea in every direction. There was Roman occupation there, and indeed occupation going back to the Mesolithic, I think. We've certainly got Mesolithic finds and maybe even a little Mesolithic scoop shelter of some kind. But then there was a very important Mercian royal monastery founded in the 670s, surviving until the Vikings knocked it about a bit in 873-4. And then after the Viking army departs, clearly some Viking population remains. As I say, they bury their dead in the mound. But by the year 1000, Repton is the centre of a very large, very important Christian parish, and the church dedicated to St. Whiston, a Mercian royal saint, is the centre of this parish with many chapelries within it. And it goes on through English history, and it becomes a monastery in the 12th century, a big monastery dedicated to St. Mary, with the Church of St. Whiston, with the earlier burials in its grounds. And then, of course, in the 16th century, with the suppression of the monastery, it becomes an English school, a grammar school, a local grammar school. And in the 19th century, it's refounded in that great wave of refoundation that created what we tend to call public schools today, which I said not really public at all, but these great schools. And it was the headmaster of Repton, who was Pears, who was one of the disciples of Dr. Arnold of Rugby, who created this school. And when you go there today, the whole of Repton is it's a sort of quintessentially English place in every way. The high street, the little shops, the market cross, the ruins of the monastery, the school, the schoolhouses. I feel quite, I feel there's an important emotional power about Repton. I think it could well be as a subtitle to a book called not quite a quintessential English place, but a typically English place, or a very English place, or something like that. This is the kind of mixed history that has made the English.
Well, it's interesting also that I was just reading a little bit about this, because the Anglo-Saxons, I've been curious about the many fights among the Germanic tribes. I mean, to a certain extent, you can say the same about the Normans, the Norman conquest, and of course that this is done via Rollo and these people. But the Anglo-Saxon people are, of course, another Germanic tribe that arrive in the 5th century. They brought with them the stories of Beowulf, for example, the Geat, and so they're separated by a few hundred years here, 400 years or so, but I very much viewed like the same people almost. They're cousins, you know?
Yes, and the languages we speak are not that different either.
No.
I mean, Danish and English, I know the ordinary person, they don't sound very similar today because the pronunciation of nouns and of consonants and vowels and so forth is very different. But I mean, it's not difficult to read. These are cognate Germanic languages. In a sense, you know, not quite true, but in a sense, know one, and you know a lot of others as well. We're very closely related. And of course, with regard to the Danes, it's always said that the English are the only people who understand their humour. different stories about the Norwegians and the Swedes, but I won't go into that.
Yeah. No, it's really, really good. This has been very interesting, Martin. And of course, do let us know if there's anything else you'd like to leave us with. I also just want to mention in passing here, of course, that you've written, you do have a couple of titles, for example, on Amazon, like The Tomb of Christ, The Church, yes, of the Holy Sepulchre, and a couple of other titles as well. Do you have a personal website? Any details you'd like to give out where people can find more of your work?
No, I've never created a website. The thing to do is to look in the prologues of those books, I suppose. I mean, The Tomb of Christ is extraordinary. Beata and I went home to our house a few hundred yards from where I'm talking to you now one evening, and the telephone rang. And a gentleman, Greville Freeman Grenville, Knight of the Holy Sepulchre, Roman Catholic, said, we have a problem. We'd like a scientific, architectural, archaeological record of the Tomb of Christ in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. We understand that you and your wife are into saints. We'd worked on St. Swithin at Winchester, St. Wiston at Repton, and St. Alban at St. Albans, and it's been suggested to us that you are the people to do it. Well, you don't turn down invitations like that. And throughout the 90s, we were in Jerusalem for a week or so every year, and that book has come out of that, and a vast range of friends, Israeli and Palestinian, wonderful connections, and more work still to do. So these things happen, you know, it's strange, really.
Well, very good. We're going to have some of the links up here, of course, to those books so people can read about those a little bit more for themselves. But I want to thank you very much for your time today, Martin, talking with us about your work at Repton and, of course, the very fascinating story here of Viking settlements there and incursions and all the battles and everything else. So it's been great having you here. Thank you again so much for your time. Right, ladies and gentlemen, good folks, if you enjoy this subject, please check out our previous shows on the topic of Vikings and Asatru. We have them linked up on our program page on redicecreations.com and also on redicemembers.com, our members website. Go there to sign up, get a hold of a subscription, and get full access to our archives, full with interesting topics. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We are going to be back with Frank De Silva on Radio 314 next. Then we have Joaquin Flores, Colin Liddell and Andy Nowicki, John Lash, Jay Dyer, Marianne Van Court, Dennis Fetcho, Laird Scranton, Swedish surveyor Jeff Gates, and Alison Weir, to name a few. Well, have a great rest of your day, and we'll be back in just a few again. Until then, take care. We'll speak soon.